Okay, it's time to commit. 2024 is the year for prioritizing yourself. Begin your new smile journey with Byte, and you could start seeing results in just 2 to 3 weeks. Just order your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95 at Byte.com. Byte Clear Aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces. Plus, they offer financing options, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA, FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Hello and welcome back to the Prep to Pro NBA Draft Podcast. My name is Ben Pfeiffer, and as always, I'm joined by my co-host Max Carlin. Max, how's it going today?
I am rejuvenated because I'm fully in 2021 film now. No more splitting the difference between the two. It's all 2021.
The wait is finally over. Football's in full effect. With many teams strutting their stuff, you might not be at a game this year, but you can still be in on the action at BetOnline. BetOnline is going the extra mile to make sure you can get in on everything imaginable this season. From game spreads and totals to team, player, and coaching props, BetOnline gives you more options to wager than any place online. Head to BetOnline today and use promo code ARMCHAIR to take advantage of all the great sign-up bonuses. BetOnline, your online sportsbook experts.
I know the timeline is filled with 2021 clips. Nature is healing. The basketball is good again. Our first pod post-2020 draft. But we are still going to be talking 2020 draft for a little bit before we fully transition to the next cycle. Today, we're going to just be doing a broad recap of the recent 2020 draft, talking about our favorite picks of the night, our least favorite picks of the night, and some trends and takeaways that we can glean from it. So without rambling anymore, let's just get into it.
Yeah, caveat at the top, though, we are recording this on Friday, November 20th at 3:06 p.m. So we're going to finish recording probably what I would assume is a two-parter right before free agency opens. We're not anticipating that a lot will change. We'll kind of make notes in situations where we think it's relevant to analyzing these picks, but just keep that in mind that we do not know what happened in the first few days of free agency. Okay, now let's get into our first favorite pick. I think one that people probably wouldn't expect based on where we were at on this guy, but he took a little bit of a tumble on draft night and ended up in a really good spot. Tyrese Haliburton to the Kings at number 12. We definitely had a lot of concerns about Haliburton winding up in a spot where he would be asked to be a primary creator. You know, had the real concerns about being in Detroit or New York or San Antonio, where I think would really be used as a guy with the ball in his hands, and it would be really tough because he can't create advantages on the ball. He can't get to the rim. He can't finish there. He's not a pull up threat. Instead, he winds up next to De'Aaron Fox, a legit young initiator. And he'll be able to play off of those advantages created by Fox and be in that linking role. Ideally, hopefully it's a spot where they can play fast. You know, Fox is so inclined to playing in transition. Then that's a place where Haliburton can really thrive as a ball handler with his creativity and vision and just selflessness. And hopefully it'll be a spot, yeah, where he's able to be used off the ball a ton, where you get the most out of his extra passing, out of his relocation, his spot up shooting. And I think this is a pretty awesome outcome for both him and the Kings.
Yeah, I mean, Haliburton really just can't tilt the defense by himself as a primary, and especially if he landed in a place like the Knicks or the Pistons, or even higher to the Bulls or the Cavs, probably be asked to do more of that. But the Kings have a legitimate defense tilter in De'Aaron Fox, someone who can bend a defense on his own with his speed and his burst and his improving handle. So yeah, Halliburton should be in a great spot to, you know, have closeouts to attack. I'm sure they'll give him some secondary pick and rolls. He has, you know, spacing, you know, for now with the presence of people like Buddy Hield or there, has spacing to operate with. I think in the future that the Kings have to do more, just get like more like defensive wings, especially at the point of attack. I think there could be some defensive struggle there. I'm not super well versed on like the point of attack defense abilities of De'Aaron Fox, but I do like that it gives them two rangy team defenders though. Ideally, you'd like a better guard defender there to, you know, kind of be able to check the better guards. But yeah, I mean, it's a really pleasantly surprising fit for Halliburton as where I think this is, you know, fit as Halliburton likely is far less likely to be overextended and thrust into a role that he can't handle and not develop positively because of it. So yeah, a really solid pick by the Kings and a really like good landing spot for Halliburton. Definitely someone who would rise for me a little bit in like a re-rank scenario. Where I'm just more confident in him landing in a role or being in a role that he is able to develop positively in because he's just, you know, he's not going to be asked to do too much. And, you know, maybe if he develops, he's going to be given time to develop into a place where he can, you know, maybe create some more on the ball a little bit.
Next, we've got Kyra Lewis. You want to talk about a little bit about this first as the Pelicans guy?
Yeah, so the Pelicans drafted Kyra. I think the value is good. I definitely think they passed on better prospects, but Kyra does make a lot of sense for this Pelicans team that has their big initiator of the future in Zion Williamson in place, though he's, you know, obviously unconventional in that role, still fulfills that, I think. But yeah, Kyra, we've talked him up plenty on this podcast as someone who can play off the ball as a guard, someone who with his blistering acceleration is great attacking closeouts, great spot up shooter, and has that technically gifted passing that, you know, thrives when Kyra has large windows to pass through and doesn't have to make particularly complex or tight angle reads and passes. And that's exactly what he's getting in the Pelicans offense playing next to Zion in the long term, as someone who commands significant and just serious interior gravity with his rim pressure and his scoring. So playing off of him as he develops as a pick and roll initiator, I think definitely we'll be able to find Zion pocket passes on lobs. And then in transition as well, the Pelicans love to run, love to get Zion out on seals. Don't really use him as much as a transition ball handler as he had in the past, but with Kyra's ability as a transition ball handler, his incredible blazing speed and his ability to change directions with things like Euro steps and get into his finishes in more space where his lack of vertical explosion and strength won't hinder his finishing as much, that's certainly a plus for him to add even more offensive value. There's still a little skeptical of his on-ball creation as the finishing is a big issue. His pick and roll craft and ability to play at multiple speeds. But I think the spacing and the offense and the offensive talent of the Pelicans really mitigates a lot of those weaknesses in the short term and helps their development in the long term. My only real worries are defensively, the Pelicans don't really have an infrastructure to cover for him. As like Zion, Ingram, Lonzo are all not spectacular defenders as the basis of their core. Eric Bledsoe is obviously a very good defender, but I don't think he factors into their long-term plan. And then like the Pelicans don't really have like a real like point guard primary initiator, as Lonzo just isn't that with his scoring gravity. Bledsoe probably is the closest thing they have to that, but again, doesn't really fit into their long-term plans. Nikhil Alexander-Walker certainly isn't that. Ingram isn't that. And again, I think Kyra probably has the best chance of anyone to develop into that if he really improves as an on-ball guy. So yeah, I mean, overall, the value is good. The fit makes a lot of sense as like an off-ball attacking, you know, speed-based attacking advantages. I think it's a positive place for his development in the long term, even if, you know, maybe he's not totally optimized in the short term given the Pelicans roster and all the guards they have. But I like the fit a lot. I think Kyra is probably going to be really good at some point in the future, just based on this developmental context.
Yeah, I'm curious to see how he turns out as an on-ball defender, just because he, you know, he does have very good recovery tools with his mobility and usage of his length, even if he's not crazy long. But you know, he is really weak. Will he be able to fight through screens? Where will his footwork turn out fighting through screens? So I think that's an important thing for them to have a really strong point of attack defender. And I'm curious to see where Kyra turns out there. I think it's conceivable to see that he could be good, but I think that the strength gains definitely need to be there. In an NBA setting, I think that'll hamper him a lot more than it did in college. But yeah, I mean, in transition offense, it makes a ton of sense. Obviously, you've got a lot of guys now who, much like the Kings, are going to want to push and are going to play kind of at their best in those settings. The half court, I think that you're just going to end up running a lot of offense through Zion, and that's kind of the way you want it. You're going to have to be creative with that, but he is a transcendent talent. That's what you do for those guys. I think that'll benefit Kyra. He'll be in situations where he can attack, already compromised defenses. Once he's in those situations, it's really hard to deal with him because of his burst, because of his spot up shooting, because of his ability to make decisions in a closeout attacking role. We'll see with the finishing. I'm worried about that hampering him for sure. I think it still makes sense. He could still be a valuable player, really thriving in transition and thriving on spot ups. And I think that he will have enough of an intermediate game to do some damage there. And if teams are really trying to dare him to finish, and you're playing pass as well on his closeout attacks, maybe he'll have some trouble. But I'm not too worried about that. In a complimentary role,
I think the real swing skills for him, like you said, is one, the finishing. With the presence, I think, of Zion, is kind of mitigated of how important that is for Kyra on this roster. And I also don't really think it's something that he's going to improve that much. The real swing skills are going to be his volume and efficiency as a pull up 3-point shooter. As that's kind of a natural and seamless pairing with a roller, a roller and a screener and just a finisher of the gravity of Zion Williamson. If he can, if teams will commit to a rolling or screening Zion, Kyra has to be able to punish them with a pull-up three if he's playing on ball. And then just his ability to improve as a pick-and-roll operator, playing less at one speed, with snakes and things, where he can function more on the ball. But yeah, I mean, I think developmentally it's a good place for him to do that, especially regarding his shooting development given the Pelicans' track record there. So yeah, I mean, it's a great pick overall. Definitely not one to complain about, and one where I think he's definitely one of the better landing spots for Kyra in terms of his long-term development.
Yeah. Next we've got Josh Green to Dallas at 18. I think this one makes a ton of sense. You have a very unique initiator in Luka Doncic, who is 6'7", and essentially defensively he's a 4. He's not going to be defending point of attack, and he is going to bring some value by working off the ball as a team defender, just making use of his size and strength and intelligence. So you do kind of need a wingy defender who is also competent on guards. And I think that that's exactly who Josh Green is, that Josh Green is going to be an elite guard defender with some ability on smaller wings as well. He is so special laterally, turning his hips. He fights over screens. He stays attached. He's very, very strong. He can really get into guys. He's, I think, just going to bring a ton of value on primary options on the defensive end, while also being a very, very good and sound team defender with some playmaking ability. On account of his intelligence, some vertical athleticism, contortion ability. I think he just really, really helps them a lot defensively. And then offensively, it's all a matter of to what level he's just willing to bomb spot ups. He's been really hesitant in the past. He's not a great shooter. I don't think he's even a good shooter. But if you can get him to a spot where he'll just take them to the point where he draws closeouts, then he can attack a closeout. He's got a nice runner. He can make really good decisions off there. And I'm always going to be skeptical on the finishing. I don't think it's ever going to be good. He is hilariously one-handed as a finisher, zero with his left whatsoever. Absolutely terrified when he has to try to attempt lefty finishes. He avoids it at all costs. He'll do crazy reverses to try to avoid that left. 7th percentile half-court rim finisher. Just a disaster there. But the rest of his game is strong, and especially that defensive role that he fills, I think, makes a ton of sense as a partner to Luka Doncic.
Yeah, I think the other really important piece of Green to the Mavs is his connecting offensive skills. Yeah, the spot up is definitely the swing skill. I'm with you in skepticism for his shot, but his indicators certainly aren't terrible. I mean, he's a good free throw shooter with good touch. Just kind of have to get him to be willing to seek out and take spot ups. And I think
the willingness point, I think, is maybe more important than the efficiency. Even like he really is a hesitant shooter.
Yeah, and he always has been. But I think Dallas is probably the best, like one of the best places to get that out of him, because he's just going to be getting so many of them. Like, and he's going to be trained and drilled into him that, you know, Dallas just like
they played MKG in the bubble.
Yeah, they did. I mean, he was like their wing stopper. So like they really need Josh Green, who I talked about. Green's kind of specialty and what makes him so rare is his ability to guard down with his feet. But I do think he can guard up a little bit, especially if he adds a little more strength. Obviously not going to be like a big wing stopper, but he's even then probably still their best option there, as they're just really limited there. But offensively, just with his connecting skills, like he's going to be a guy who, if the spot up works and if he's willingness to improve his volume, he's a really, really good wing passer, able to, you know, make quick decisions and run even a little bit of secondary pick and roll. He had some just ridiculous highlight passes this year in transition. So I think with his ability to be a ball mover and a cutter and finish and, you know, hit those floaters in the intermediate, he gives the Mavericks just another offensive piece they really don't have, especially, you know, just next to Luka Doncic with all of the gigantic vacated space he creates. That just makes it all the easier for Green to deal with his limited burst, and, you know, makes it so there's going to be more room in the paint for him to operate and make plays. So all around, it's just a beautiful fit for him to maximize his defensive strengths and to mitigate his offensive weaknesses and again, optimize those strengths he has on the floor. So it's a great fit. Definitely. We've talked about the scarcity of real defensive wings in this class. And even though he was picked at 18, he was like technically a little lower on both of our boards. I think we can both agree it's really, really good value just because of how important that position is, especially to a team like the Mavericks and how few of those are in this class. So yeah, overall an excellent pick on both ends. And I'm really excited about this one.
Yeah, next we have Precious Achiuwa, 20th to Miami, which I think on the broadcast, at least, we disagreed on a little bit. I like it quite a bit. Maybe you've changed your opinion on it. But obviously, the BAM comparisons will be natural and are not entirely warranted, as we've discussed in the past. But I do very much like the idea of Precious going to the spot where they developed BAM into BAM. You're taking a guy who is very able as a mover. He needs to develop movement skill. By that I mean just biting less on dribble moves, biting less on ball fakes. But he is capable as a mover. So he's capable of being a really, really high level mover if you rein him in. He's a super high energy player. And it's a spot where I think he can hopefully be constrained and really only see minutes as a center. If they're hoping that he is going to be BAM, I think they'll be disappointed from definitely a decision-making and handling standpoint. And in the short term, I think from a enabling a switch everything standpoint. But long term, I think that defensively he can maybe approximate some of that. And there's kind of no better spot offensively to develop him than Miami, even if I'm highly skeptical of like the touch shots that BAM has being there, definitely the decision-making, the handling. I'm skeptical of all of that, but a spot where they're so good developmentally, where they have this experience with BAM, I do think it makes a lot of sense.
Yeah. My feelings on this one are still a little mixed. I can't disagree that this is probably the best developmental context for Precious, just in terms of their organizational structure and their culture and what they value. My real big worry is just his positionality. And if they force him to be anything but a five, since they already kind of have BAM, I do think it's a solid indicator that, you know, they see this player that can be like BAM. I just worry that, you know, they try to turn. I think there's a chance, even if it's a small chance, that they try to turn him into a big wing. They maybe see some of the, you know, some of the handling and the shot making that he did on limited occasion at Memphis, and are enticed to work him on the perimeter. And obviously that's not good for Precious. And even if the Heat are probably the best team to give him a chance of success in that role, I still don't think it's really possible. But I do like the fit for all of the same reasons that you mentioned. I think having Precious, because again, not Bam, making him Bam would be a problem, but someone who definitely presents a lot of the same strengths and a lot of similar abilities. So being able to like run your defensive scheme, basically whenever, even when Bam is off the floor, especially hopefully in the playoffs, is really, really critical. Getting another big who's going to play with incredible motor and effort, has the mobility to play similar pick and roll coverages. Obviously not this switch everything that Bam does, because nobody can do that, but just being able to blitz pick and rolls and hedge pick and rolls and late switch, I think at his ceiling with Miami, Precious is definitely going to be capable of that. So just having another version of Bam to kind of anchor their defensive schemes, so they don't really have to make alterations. And if they can do that for 48 minutes of every playoff game, that's going to be really, really difficult to match. So I do certainly like this one. Again, a little more mixed than you are, I think. But I mean, this is undoubtedly like a good pick and one of the better ones in the draft. And certainly someone who would rise a lot for me in a re-rank, just because, I mean, Miami's the organizational fit, the developmental context is really great. It's one of the best in the league. So I think the outlook for Precious is definitely a lot better now than it was if he landed somewhere else.
And that's kind of the thing. Like, Precious is a specialized role player, but now if you're in a situation where going small for 48 minutes a game in the playoffs doesn't mean playing Andre Iguodala at center. It means playing someone like Precious who, down the road, he's much more capable of at least something close to a switch everything, then that's pretty interesting, especially at the 20th pick, to get a guy who can kind of enable you to play in that way that we saw is really, really destructive for other teams. Like, if you can play like that for 48 minutes, that's pretty scary. So I like it a lot. I think it makes a lot of sense.
I mean, definitely has, I think, the chance to go a little poorly, but has the chance to go really, really well, assuming they play it right, which I think there's honestly probably more reason than not to give them credit to just kind of believe that they will.
Yeah. Next, we've got one of many that is going to cause me a great deal of pain. Tyrese Maxey to Philly at 21. So a top five or six guy on both of our boards. Maxey is like the great complimentary scorer in this draft. I think he can definitely shoot with versatility off the move, off the dribble, off the catch. His track record as a shooter is so strong. He can score in the intermediate because he's got beautiful balance on his pull up. He's got an elite floater that was really good at Kentucky, but we didn't even see the full extent of it. It was so ridiculous in youth levels. And then at the rim, he's a special guard finisher. He has unique strength. Like I said, that balance is unbelievable. Incredible ambidexterity, great craft. He's probably best in class using the rim to protect his finishes. Always leaves shot contesters with uncertainty as to which side of the rim he's going to try to finish on. And he's just constantly using that rim for protection. So three level scoring ability while being a really, really good guard defender with, I think, a little bit of positional versatility, even though he is small, just because he's so strong and physical and tries so hard. Really solid team defender. I think for Philly, maybe a little bit less half court off the dribble game than I would ideally want. I think it's a little worse. It would be a little more desirable then to have someone like Malachi Flynn, but Tyrese Maxey is just such a better prospect than that, and so good at what he does in that complimentary guard role, that I think it was 100% worth it and was the pick of the night, especially when you consider that they also moved Josh Richardson and one of the seconds to get Seth Curry, who does have more of that off the bounce game, that he can be a bit of a half court creator for them. So I think that Tyrese Maxey makes a ton of sense. He's a spectacular prospect. It was an incredible mixture of value and fit. he's going to be so good for them, and it's going to make me very upset for a long time.
Yeah, he really opens up the floor and opens up the offense for Embiid and Simmons in a way that they haven't had in a long time, really. Just as someone who has the spacing and the ability to kind of bend defense once he attacks a closeout or off of a secondary pick and roll, like just you can just imagine. You know, Maxey absolutely annihilating defenses off of the post up gravity of Joel Embiid, where you know teams will send even like a second defender just shading at Embiid. That'll be enough to get Maxey the tiny sliver of airspace he needs to carve up the defense and create an easy shot for himself. And hopefully, as he progresses as a playmaker, create an easy shot for others. And then obviously just gives Ben Simmons more of the spacing he's able to operate. The shooting and the defensive versatility just gives them more and more lineup flexibility regarding Simmons and Embiid. So all around, it makes so much sense. And I mean, the whole Sixers revamp, we'll talk a little more about that later, is really just spectacular with what they've done, just totally evolving the fit of this roster and just really, really changing the long-term outlook. And it starts with Maxey being that really, really potent secondary creator. I mean, as like the third best player on a championship team, I think he profiles as that nicely. And I think that's what he could be here in Philadelphia for a long time.
Yep. Next, we've got Malachi Flynn, 29, to the Raptors. Oh man, it's so good. I'm not going to say that he is like the FBV replacement. But yeah, he's the best pick and roll player in college basketball last year. His pick and roll scoring is so unbelievable. It is so diverse. He on every single possession, he can break out something new to just destroy the big man. He has everything from, he can snake into the CP elbow jumper. He really likes to go to his in and out while moving downhill to turn the big and then get to the rim to finish. He can vary his stride length. He can play at different paces. He has his elite runner, of course, with great balance, great strength through contact, at the rim. He's an incredible craft finisher. He uses both hands. He has every small guard finish you could ever want. The Nash layups, the just weird pacing, inside hand stuff. It's so incredible how good his pick and roll scoring is. And then he adds to that that he's a good pick and roll passer and a very, very good pull-up shooter, very good off-ball player, really, really smart relocator. And then on the defensive end, strong, physical, smart, tries hard. And he's I think the best gambler in the class. That his gambles are very well, they're executed with very good timing, and they're not bad gambles. Like he it doesn't feel like he's taking risks. They're very, very calculated gambles, and they tend to work out. So he even brings value as a team defender. He's such a good player. Not only am I confident in him as a backup point guard, but we've talked about this in the past that, you know, should we be accounting for a little bit with Malachi that he has some serious sort of creator upside, because he is just such a well-rounded offensive, I mean, and defensive player. We've talked about this in the past, and I think you have to really consider that with Toronto. This is a team that has had so much success developing small guards that they, like, of course, Lowry was a very good player before he was there. But he really blossomed into a superstar there. That Fred VanVleet rose from undrafted free agent into a guy who's about to get paid with Toronto. You have to think that there's at least a chance that Malachi really realizes some of those tail end outcomes and becomes, instead of just a very good pick that we think he is, something even more intimidating than that.
Yeah, we talk about the high-end developmental teams. Toronto certainly ranks towards the top of those. Yeah, it just makes sense with a Toronto team that, you know, runs a pretty simple offense, requires and expects a lot of their perimeter players to handle and dribble and pass and shoot. And again, Malachi works perfectly with his intersection of on and off ball play. I think makes a lot of sense. Like, again, playing next to Lowry at, you know, as like a proto Van Fleet. I mean, it's like, it's such an easy comparison. Like, obviously they're different players there, but it's a really easy, you know, fit, especially if Van Fleet ends up walking. I mean, you can see it being pretty quick for Malachi to step into that role as that secondary pick and roll creator. I think definitely like loosen up, you know, run some pick and rolls with Siakam and loosen up the floor for him. It's just a beautiful fit. And then defensively with the Raptors, Raptors loving to play aggressively at the nail, which Malachi is great at. Again, just developing his point of attack defense even more. I think it's an awesome fit. It's a scary good fit and value. Like, he's gonna be so good.
I'm so happy for him and for the Raptors that it's this wonderful marriage of a fantastic organization and just such a joyous player. I think it's gonna be really fun to track his development, or really painful if you root for another team in that division.
I mean, he doesn't need like complex offense or like anything or like really complex things to succeed. Just give him pick and rolls and he's gonna thrive. He's someone who can definitely, I think, also help run their bench unit if you want to stagger him with Lowry and Siakam, someone who a player who can help create and drive offense definitely against bench units, I think, as he develops. So overall, I mean, as a starting complement, as someone who helps that team in so many different ways, it's a beautiful fit and a beautiful value.
The wait is finally over. Football's in full effect. With many teams strutting their stuff, you might not be at a game this year, but you can still be in on the action at BetOnline. BetOnline is going the extra mile to make sure you can get in on everything imaginable this season. From game spreads and totals to team, player, and coaching props, BetOnline gives you more options to wager than any place online. Head to BetOnline today and use promo code ARMCHAIR to take advantage of all the great sign-up bonuses. BetOnline, your online sportsbook experts. Support for the Prep to Pro NBA Draft podcast comes from Manscaped, who is the best in men's below-the-belt grooming. Manscaped offers precision-engineered tools for your family jewels. Jingle balls to the walls, fellas. Listen up. Untrimmed pubes are a thing of the past. It's time to gear up and get yourself the gift of shaving this holiday season. I am talking about the Manscaped Perfect Package 3.0. The Lawnmower 3.0 comes inside their brand new Perfect Package 3.0, which makes for the perfect gift this holiday season. It's literally everything you need to keep trimmed, cut free, and smelling nice down there. The Manscaped Perfect Package 3.0 also includes the Crop Preserver, an anti-chafing ball deodorant and moisturizer. You already put deodorant on your armpits. Why are you not putting it on the smelliest part of your body? And yes, your balls stink. Get 20% off and free shipping with the code ARMCHAIR at manscaped.com. That's 20% off with free shipping at manscaped.com and use code ARMCHAIR. Clean up your nuts and make Santa proud this year.
Next, we have one of the guards who fell, something that we kept talking about on our best plays and on various preview pods, that there were so many guards in this late first range that some are going to fall until the mid to late second. And so you saw, Devon Dotson go undrafted. You saw Trey Jones in the 40s. But the one that we really liked was Nico Mannion at 48 to Golden State, because I think you said this on the live broadcast that I kind of spoke it into existence with my sacrilegious theft comp for Nico's, specifically after pass relocation. So
he's still coughing the Steph.
It is just funny that Nico Mannion, the best after pass relocator in the class, winds up in Golden State. A spot
best
here.
After pass relocator of all time.
Yeah, a spot where he's going to be able to play in an offense that, well, yes, it emphasizes pick and roll more now, is still a heavy off-screen offense. I think it's awesome for Nico. I think it's a spot where he could actually be a pretty valuable player. So I'm happy about that. And also a spot where they've had a lot of success developing kind of scrawny guards physically, that they so famously built up Steph. From a strength perspective, if they can really do that with Nico.
Yeah, and Nico's not even starting from that low of a baseline.
No, but if you, especially with Nico, if you can really strengthen him up, he can be even better defensively. And I already think that he's fine on that end. Hopefully can add some more consistency to his jumper there. I think it's a really good spot for him. I think he could turn into a pretty useful player there. And at 48, that's pretty awesome.
Yeah, Nico went from about the worst possible context that he could be in as just a full-time on-ball primary creator who was tasked with pretty much generating like 80-90% of Arizona's offense, to one where he's going to be asked to play to his greatest strength. So it's about as good of a swap in team construction for Nico as you could possibly imagine. Oh my god, I didn't like Nico. I mean, I just like Nico, but not as much as you do. But I can't deny that this is probably the best fit for him to be really, really useful. Like, this is the spot for him to be at that third guard. Obviously, you know, with Klay Thompson's Achilles injury, not right now or maybe not ever, but, you know, next to Steph, next to Draymond, we've talked about the Warriors, like, just needing NBA players desperately. Like, they just need guys who can play, especially at guard, where outside of Curry, they've been really, really depleted these past couple years. And I think Nico could actually probably contribute in year one a little bit. Like,
I'm skeptical of Nico contributing in year one. Long term,
I think off the bench he could, like, for like 10, 11 minutes a game if they need him to. I mean, just have him run around screens and shoot, and then just like defend a bench guard. Like, I think there's avenues for that. Like, I'm not saying he's going to be like super impactful.
I think that Nico can't defend bench guards in year one, and the shooting off screens, maybe if he can actually do it at a high enough level right now.
Yeah, I suppose.
Yeah, I don't know that Nico's contributing in year one on a real team, but I do like it long term. Long term, it makes
sense. Either way, it works really well for his development, a spot where he's certainly not going to be asked to do more than he can handle. And can thrive in those off screen situations. Take advantage of that passing ability. In a more spaced out open floor where he doesn't have to operate in tight slots and create his own advantages. So yeah, I mean, it's a great fit, an excellent value late in the second. Again, like we said, some of these guard prospects were bound to fall, and Nico fell into a slot where it is kind of perfect for him to really be a valuable role player in the long term, I think.
So. Yeah, next we have Mr. Irrelevant, Sam Merrill, who went 60th to the Bucks. I don't know if Merrill can play from day one for them, but I think that there's a chance with the 60th pick that
he might have to. But
yeah, I mean, he's,
I don't know if he can, but
he's an elite shooter. With for that off guard role, will have like certainly plus playmaking ability because he was an on ball guard in college, and is a smart player. And then defensively, just a guy who's underrated. He can get over screens. He is a smart team defender. Obviously, he's not a playmaker with his physical tools, but like, he's not a catastrophic defensive player, and he can really shoot, and I think he can play make on closeout attacks. He could conceivably play for them, and yeah, they're such a roster crunch, such a financial crunch, that a guy who's going to be making the rookie minimum, who is the 60th pick, might actually be able to see minutes for them. That's pretty huge. I really like this pick a lot. Really good spot for Sam Merrill and a nice get for Milwaukee.
Yeah, I'm skeptical that he's able to really contribute. Like, I'm certainly not skeptical that he might be forced to play just because of what the Bucks have done and what they're doing. I think they're definitely, almost certainly, will be games where he's forced to actually play real minutes. I'm skeptical of how much he can really contribute just based on his physical limitations at the moment. But I certainly think, you know, just as like down the road, and, you know, maybe even in a couple of years, hopefully in a couple of years, you know, for his sake, the Bucks are still going to be competing for a championship in a year or two or three. But yeah, I just, as, you know, another one of those off guards, more of like an off wing, really, just an elite shooter in all facets with some ancillary passing and handling. Like it makes a ton of sense next to in a Giannis led offense where dribble pass shoot guards and wings on the perimeter are really, really key, and just taking advantage of the spacing and the rim gravity that Giannis and that whole Bucks offense creates. I mean with Budenholzer's tendencies with rotations, you might actually see Merrill play in the playoffs. Like, I don't know about that one. But I mean, yeah, I mean, it's certainly a perfect fit. The fact that Merrill is already like at 24 entering his prime, the fact that he's on a contending team right now and conceivably could contribute, you know, in the playoffs in the next couple of years, like it's kind of a perfect fit. And at the 60th pick, which, you know, you rarely see contribute, I think there's a real chance that Merrill is like a valuable asset for this Bucks team.
Yeah, I mean, he was just a really good value by my board also, that I had him in the solid rotational gambles tier. I had him 44th for whatever that rank matters. But, you know, a guy would have comfortably taken in the mid-second to get him at 60th on a team that is trying to win a championship, and does need you know, shooters and can make use of a guy that size who's a dribble pass shoot guy, but is, you know, athletically and creation wise limited. It makes a ton of sense. I think it's a really awesome value and a good player.
Yeah. So the last players or group of picks that we had are just prospects whose fit is less complicated or doesn't really need as much discussion. Just really good players who ended up fitting with teams, you know, at really good value. So we have Killian Hayes of the Pistons, Isaac Okoro of the Cavs, Desmond Bane and Xavier Tillman to the Grizzlies, and Isaiah Joe to the Sixers. All was just, you know, players who very good players that we like a lot that landed, you know, in value spots where we think they're going to have a chance to succeed. You know, not as complicated or as nuanced with their fit as these other guys maybe, or their development, but just really great spots for all of them.
Yeah, to add a little bit on those guys, I think that Tillman is a guy who can maybe play with JJJ and help to mitigate some of his like rebounding issues while JJJ, you know, brings some weak side rim protection and can maybe help account for the fact that Tillman is a little bit smaller as a center. And then Bane is a guy who can bring shooting to them that they need on the wing. The Joe fit is maybe a little bit more noteworthy as well, that they finally have a guy who can play in that JJ Redick DHO game with Embiid. That Joe, he's viewed as just a gunner, but very much has off the dribble shooting. Like, he was an elite pull-up shooter both of his years at Arkansas, even with the overall shooting numbers varying a lot. That, yeah, he's a guy who can certainly take one dribble and pull up. I think that that's just, you know, a skill set that they certainly need in Philadelphia, and was an unbelievable value at, what did he go, 40?
49, I think.
49, yeah, 49. Yeah.
Unbelievable. Man.
Yeah, what a draft by Philly.
Really unbelievable, yeah. I just wanted to mention a little bit about Okoro, which I talked about. I think Killian's pretty straightforward, just, you know, the best player available by a mile on a team devoid of young talent. But yeah, I mean, fit with Okoro to the Cavs, just a perfect fit, given the rest of their young talent, as I think a really positive piece for their development as an unlocking talent with his wing playmaking and his slashing.
And his Cantor just got traded.
I just saw Max Ennis Cantor traded to, wait, Desmond. Oh, just kidding.
That's
part of the Desmond Bane trade. Okay. Yeah. I was going to say, like, did they trade Desmond Bane? Portland and his Cantor. Nice.
Oh, man.
Nice.
This is wonderful.
Something to raise Max's spirits after what the Celtics did to him on Wednesday night.
It's all worth it. I don't have to watch Enes Kanter anymore. all right, back to the podcast.
Yeah, I was like, Max, why are you so excited about Okoro? I mean, I know we like Okoro, but
I do love Okoro. I think this is a great pick. Okay, sorry, Ben, continue.
I just think he's like not only being a great value and a great fit for their current roster, and I think he's a great developmental kind of unlocking piece for the rest of their talent. Because Garland and Sexton and Kevin Porter Jr., like he gives them a playmaking complement they don't have. I think Okoro is easily the best passer of that group of prospects, and then probably the best slasher as well. And easily the best slasher as well with his strength and his finishing. And just his ability to carve out space and draw fouls. So I think offensively he unlocks a lot. And then defensively being really like their only stalwart wing POA defender in the short term helps them a lot. Obviously just being an incredible wing defender in the long term with the offense that I really believe in. And, you know, assuming they want to keep investing in Garland and Sexton, I think a construction where he's going to have spacing, going to be able to be used off of the ball. It's just a fit for the short and the long term. Given the rest of their talent that I like, just someone that unlocks and optimizes the rest of what they do. Again, one of my absolute favorite picks of the night was Okoro.
They got BPA, a scarce position in general in the league, a scarce position in the draft, and it's a spot where they've got multiple handlers and hopefully can make use of him. I think Kevin Love is a really, really good complement developmentally for Okoro to give him some space to play in. Yeah, I think it's really awesome. That was a great pick. I think less of like a wild standout than these other ones, but just really, really solid, yeah, really smart.
Yeah. Not a pick that was like hard to predict or anything that just like blows you away.
No, but they were constantly being mocked, like OB, which I think would have been pretty disastrous. But they didn't do it. They went with the like really smart, solid pick, and I'm a huge fan of it.
Yeah, they did. Yeah, I suppose. I mean, I think there was some Okoro news there, but yeah, I mean, the OB thing was there. Even like the Denny thing was there. But, yeah, I mean, Okoro was easily the right decision for them.
Yeah, I mean, Denny was probably very widely viewed as a better prospect, and they passed on Denny at a similar role, similar position, and took the guy that we both think is a superior prospect. So I was a huge fan of that. I really liked it.
It was great business by the Cleveland Cavaliers for once. Definitely their best draft in a while, I think, just by virtue of picking Okoro where they did.
Should we start some least favorite picks before we move on to part two?
Yeah, I saw your tweet.
So first we've got a player who we like a lot, unlike a lot of these other least favorite picks, but was just kind of a baffling selection. Maybe this will be explained in the next few days before this is released. But Onyeka Okongwu at 6 to the Hawks. I don't really understand what they're doing there at all.
It's a weird one. It's certainly strange.
It's just I'm worried now that he is going to be playing the 4 almost because they have Clint Capela there. They have John Collins there. Onyeka Okongwu is not a 4. His appeal is as a coverage versatile 5. Like I think the value of getting a Okongwu at 6 is totally fine with me. He fits very well with Trey. I think he would do a lot to help Trey. It's just weird with who's currently on the roster, and that's not to say that makes it a bad pick. I'm just still waiting for another shoe to drop. I'm just confused as to what they're doing there. Not necessarily that you can't invest in a center if you think that, especially if you think that he's the best player available and that he makes sense with really the only guy you should be accounting for with Trey. It's just, what's your plan developmentally for Okongwu is my concern. Like to be very clear, it's not that because you had centers, you can't draft Okongwu. It's just, is this going to mean that Onyeka Okongwu is playing the 4 now? Because that would be really bad. That would be really bad for developing Onyeka Okongwu as a player. So it's just concern over how he is now going to be used, how his development arc is going to proceed, because he needs to be playing the 5. And ideally not next to another big man who's playing the 4 either. Like, so it just TBD where Onyeka Okongwu is playing, who he's playing alongside. I'm concerned about what's going on developmentally there.
Yeah, I absolutely agree with the kind of roster construction there being wonky. I don't think you really want Collins at the 4 long-term. Definitely don't want Onyeka. Just what are they doing with Clint Capela? But just taking into account the other side, assuming they do view Onyeka Okongwu as their long-term big man next to Trae Young, I think it's a really good fit developmentally for Onyeka and for the Hawks as a whole. Just, first of all, I think it's a great spot for his offensive development. Just having the gravity of Trae Young to be able to find Onyeka on the short roll and foster those learned reads like we talked about with him and continue improving his short roll passing. He'll have loads of space to finish in with all of the shooting wings that they're kind of accruing at this point. Like offensively, I think it's an excellent fit. You know, playing with Trae is like any role man's dream. So I think that's a really, really great fit. And then defensively, again, just as someone to cover for, to continue helping cover for and insulate Trey with the glut of wings they're building, it works a lot defensively as well, though you'd probably want a better like weak side rim protecting 4 next to him in the long term. So I do think if like based, like Max said, we're going to see what their plan is in the next couple of days, probably assuming they, you know, maybe they want to commit to Onyeka in a way that would probably surprise a lot of people, ourselves included. If they do that, or choose to commit to Onyeka as their long-term big man, then yeah, I think that it could be really good. And I don't think that's the decision they really have to make. Like they could certainly use him off the bench and hold off on making that decision in year one. I don't think that would stunt his development that much. But they do definitely have to make a decision eventually, because they can't, you know, they can't use Onyeka as a 4 long-term, or else they're just wasting the value of the 6th pick. You have to do something with Capela or Collins or Onyeka really here. So I definitely have a little bit of optimism for this one, because there are a lot of ways that it could go very right for them. But yeah, there's also a lot of ways that it just is kind of confusing and doesn't make a lot of sense. Again, not really banging on it too hard at this point, because I'm just waiting to see what their plan is, because that's gonna dictate what I really think about this pick and this fit.
Yeah. I mean, it's just like, as it stands, you have 48 center minutes, and like Onyeka Okongwu and Clint Capela should play 0 minutes together, and you know, maybe they're both are just going to play 24 minutes. I feel like that's probably a poor investment with Capela, and Okongwu as a rookie maybe doesn't have to play more than that. But you just spent the sixth pick on the guy. Like, ideally, I would think going forward, he's going to be more than a mid-20s minutes guy. I think that's kind of the appeal with Okongwu, is that he can kind of play no matter what. It's just it's really odd. Developmentally is questionable. Maybe you can get by for a year with it, where you can keep them from overlapping. But I worry about what it means developmentally for Onyeka.
I'm optimistic. I'm like a little bit hopeful for the long term. Again, just gonna
on the bright side. I mean, he's a very good player. He's a prospect that we like. I have no problem spending the sixth pick on him in a
and
vacuum.
Just like with Trae Young, there, you know, which, like we said, is the only guy they're looking to be accounting for. He's kind of a perfect match there with Trae for a big man.
Yeah, and I mean the Collins thing isn't like prohibitive either. It's just that it makes no sense that they just also traded for a highly paid center. It's confusing. I don't know what's going on there, but we'll wait and see.
It's weird, but that, yeah, I mean, for me especially, like, that's more of like a hate pick than just like a, well, it's kind of weird, and how we feel about this pick is going to change a lot based on what they do in the next
episode. I mean, when this episode is released on Monday, this pick could make total sense.
Yeah, which is definitely something that we're going to be accounting for here, which is what we're making sure we account for here, that this pick could make a lot more sense than, or it could make similarly less sense. We don't know, and we're going to find out.
Okay. Another one that's concerning is Obi Toppin 8 to the Knicks. Don't love the value, obviously. Just thought Obi was not this level of prospect. But I'm really concerned since he is fundamentally a complimentary big man. They have no creation on that roster. Who is putting Obi in positions to succeed? Who is getting Obi the ball on the roll?
I can't wait for them to run Julius Randle, Obi Toppin pick and rolls.
Who is throwing Obi lobs? I just really worry that then by default to get him involved, what are you doing? Are you posting up Obi Toppin, who has the world's highest center of gravity and will not be able to move anyone, will just get stonewalled by every single NBA center and like probably most NBA wings, maybe some NBA guards. Is that what you're gonna be doing? Are you gonna be isolating Obi Toppin on the perimeter? Like, I just don't understand how you're going to be getting the ball to Obi without a big-time creator on the roster. And this is one where it could change a little bit. They could sign Gordon Hayward. They could sign Fred VanVleet. But those guys are more secondary creator types also. Like, if Fred VanVleet is the one that's charged with running your entire offense, I worry about him getting Obi the ball in those situations. I certainly worry about that with Gordon Hayward, even though he himself is a very strong creator too. It is more of a secondary role, an additional passing. And then in bench units, he can certainly create like that, but he is not a big time compromiser of the defense. It's more, yeah, he'll make good decisions, but he does get his own offense off of a diet of kind of tough shots. So I worry a lot about putting Obi Toppin in a position to succeed with this team, for a team that just doesn't have a lot in place. If you know, even if they end up with Fred VanVleet or Gordon Hayward, I worry about it, but man, if it's RJ Barrett is the one who's running pick and roll with Obi Toppin, oh man, that's tough. And then that doesn't even get at the fact that their big core piece is supposed to be Mitchell Robinson, and they
overlap. As our friend Jake said on the live show, they are both play finishers. Obi has a little more skill than Mitch Robinson, obviously, with his passing and some of the handling and shooting. But fundamentally, their best usage is as play finishers, as role men, as cutters, as dunker spot guys. And again, they overlap in ways that you wouldn't want with overlapping with maybe your best prospect. So, I mean, I'm totally in agreement with this pick being catastrophic for a lot of reasons. But I mean, the silver lining, I guess, is Obi will certainly keep you bad enough to where if you land someone like Cade next year, then that certainly changes the calculus for Obi, where you do have a long-term guy who can be that play finisher and that the elite complementary big offensively next to a really good franchise changing initiator level talent. We've talked about a strategy for the Knicks in the past being, you know, loading up on complementary guys. You know, we had thought of that as like wings, you know, taking Vassell or Pat Will if he fell, or Green or someone like that. I guess you could view Obi through that same lens as this year kind of not mattering for him, though obviously every year matters for development, and this is a terrible developmental context. We saw that exact same thing with RJ Barrett last year, where though neither of us were very in on RJ, I think it's clear that he was thrust into a role that he totally cannot handle, being like a primary creator for the Knicks. And despite our skepticism of RJ Barrett, I think he's definitely capable of more than he showed in his rookie year. Obi certainly would, I think, could fall into that same trap. I think there's hope that for the future, Obi Toppin, you know, if the Knicks can really land that creator, eventually helps them a lot down the road. Or maybe he's just a really solid second contract guy. I mean, on a second contract, he'll be like entering his prime, or his physical prime, you know. But so maybe just looking for some positivity here. Like, he is a very good offensive big, but just does not have the infrastructure or the context to succeed at all. Like, it's really, really a struggle with this pick and just kind of the context that he's been thrust into, especially kind of with at least one of the other picks the Knicks made, which we're going to get into next part, which certainly doesn't help Obi as much as he could. But yeah, it was definitely in the top 10. Like, even Denny would have been better, who went one spot later. Like, Denny would have been better. Vassell would have been better. Kyra would have been better. Maxi would have been better. Cole would have been better. Poku would have been better. Yeah, it's rough.
All right, part one in the book.
Yep, that was part one of our post-draft recap. Once again, thank you all for listening. As always, you can follow the pod at Prep2ProPod on Twitter. Follow Max at MaxACarlin. Follow me at Ben_Pfeiffer_. And with that, we'll see you all in the next part.